Professor, you are muted.
Thank you. Okay. As I was just saying, good morning. Plan for today is to continue with integration and its relationship to derivatives. And in fact, we'd like to finally get some facts back about derivatives that don't refer to integrals by use of those integrals. Give a little bit of a picture of what the various spaces are that are involved and what facts we know about them already, and then which new ones we get. So I kind of like these diagrams. I don't know if everyone gets as much as I do out of them, but I find that they sort of clarify where things stand. So let me start. So I'm going to start with the Riemann integrable functions on a space AB. And we found various facts about those. One was that they contain the continuous functions, among other things. What we found last time was that we can get a continuous function from a Riemann integrable function by integrating. And so we can call that map J. And this is a 12.6. And it enabled us to get a continuous function by integrating. Okay, we also found earlier that we could take a continuously differentiable function, differentiate it, and we got a continuous function. And what we'd like to do is see sort of how the integral goes back the other way. Now, actually, I want to modify this a little bit. Let me add a little zero here at the bottom. And that little zero is just going to mean that these are the functions whose value at A is zero. And that's because that's what we get when we integrate. So this is just the set of all functions that are continuously differentiable. So they're in C1AB, but they also have the extra property. That's what that subscript zero says, is that if I look at the left endpoint, I get the value zero. And the reason I wanted to put that in is that that now gives us the fact that this derivative is now an inclusion by theorem 8.35. But if I have two functions whose derivatives are the same, they differ by a constant. And so if they have the same value at zero, then that constant is zero. So they're the same function. So that's something that we already knew. Okay, and let me add a little bit more to my diagram. We also have differentiable functions on AB, and those are all continuous, and they contain the functions that are continuously differentiable, but not all of them are continuously differentiable. And examples would be things like x squared sine of 1 over x. Right, that's something that would live here in the D1, but not in, in C1. Okay, but nonetheless, they're differentiable, so we can differentiate them, and that is what we do. So we take the derivative of those, and once again, by the same theorem, that's an inclusion. And then we just gave a name to the image, which was D0 of AB. So those are all the derivatives. All right, and what we would like to do now is try to understand a little bit more about going back and forth. And also, there was a claim right at the beginning that every continuous function is a derivative. And this we're going to prove today. Okay, so we're going to prove that every continuous function is, in fact, a derivative. All right, so that's going to follow from what we have here. All right, and let's see. So this, we figured out exactly what the derivative of that function is. Okay, so you can compute that as we did earlier. Okay, so those are just some examples. Oh, maybe I'll just add one more example. We also have Riemann integrable functions that are not in some of these other places. So these would be functions like I have here, the continuous function, which is the absolute value of x. And that arises as an integral if I take the function that's, say, I'll just draw a graph of it, but it's a negative one or one, right? So that's a function that's integrable, but it's not continuous. So those are some examples of functions that live in those different function spaces. Okay, so so that's my picture. Now I can write down some theorems. Okay, so let me do that. So the first theorem that I want is theorem my 12.4. Let me just write it out. And what it's going to do is show that this map here is isomorphism. And so I'm going to try to go back the other way. And I'm going to say that this integral allows me to go back the other way. So that's what I'm going to prove now. So if we have a function f, which is a Riemann integrable, on an interval AB, and it's continuous at C, some point inside of AB, and the most interesting case will be where it's continuous at every point, but as long as it's continuous at one point, that's enough for our conclusion. And that is that when I take the derivative of the integral of my function f and evaluate it at C, I get C. And let me recall the notation. So this is clear, JF of C just means the integral from A to C of f of g dt. Okay, and D is just the derivative. So DF of C is f prime. All right, so those are the names that I was using. Okay, let's see, so let's prove this. And then get a couple of corollaries that follow from that. So proof. All right, well, let's see. So we're assuming that our function is continuous at C. So what I want to do is see how much that gives us and then go on to computing this. So let me start with the fact that it's continuous and see what that tells us. So since f is continuous at C, that tells us that the for every epsilon greater than zero, and this epsilon is going to carry through the whole proof. So remember, this is happening for every epsilon greater than zero. Everything in the rest of the proof will be that. So then there exists, because it's continuous, some delta also greater than zero, so that whenever I have a little h that's smaller than a delta in absolute value, we have that the value of my function f there is close to what it is at C. So when I shift it by h, so let me just write that out. F evaluated at C plus this small amount h is somewhere between f evaluated at C minus epsilon and f evaluated at C plus epsilon. Okay, that's the biggest difference it can have is epsilon away from the value at C. Okay, all right, so that's what it means. And that tells us some things. Now, keeping in mind that we're eventually going to compute this derivative of an integral, right? So when we compute this integral, so the integral here, that involves the sup and the int. Okay, so let's so that's going to be what matters. So let's compute that also. Hence, if I take the sup or the int of over size of h less than delta of f evaluated at x c plus h, well, this is in also in the same regime because every point is. So the sup is similar to the int. Right, since every value is in there, of course, the biggest and smallest ones do also. All right, but that helps us. This is going to help us with the integral. So, I have that the integral, and I just want an integral around a little tiny bit. Let me draw a little picture over here. So I have my value c, and c plus h is some small distance away, and I have my function And the point is that my function has some value here, f of c, and it doesn't change much, at least not by more than epsilon. When I move up just by delta. Okay, so then when I look at the integral from c to h, right, that's the area under this curve here, right? So that area is going to be bounded by the maximum or the minimum times the width here, and that width is going to be h. Okay, so let me just draw that. And so let me write that. Out. So I'm going to write now the integral from c to c plus h, so exactly as in my drawing, of my function f of t dt. Okay, and so then the question is, how big can that be? So this is between All right, well, see, so the biggest it can be is if I take the maximum here and then multiply that by the width, right? And so that maximum is going to be this f of c plus epsilon, and the width is h. So the biggest it can be, well, the smallest it can be is h times f of c minus epsilon. And the biggest it can be is h times f of c plus epsilon. Okay, so does that make sense? Any question about that? So this is just using the single, I can add an extra step if that's not clear. Okay. All right, so I have gotten a bound on my integral. And now I'm going to go back and do the computation here that I have asserted that these two things are equal. I'm just going to compute that left-hand side, and that integral is going to come in one of the steps when I do that integration, when I do that computation. So let me try it. So compute. All right, so I'm going to take the dj f of c, which is supposed to be a f of c. It should be f of c, right? So it's a derivative of j. So let me just unpack the definitions. So it's a derivative. So this is the limit as h goes to zero, right, of j f at c plus h minus j f at c, just using the definition of a derivative divided by the h, okay? All right, so that's one definition. And now I'm gonna use the definition of j. So the definition of j here is this integral, right? So I'm going to plug in that integral for j. So then I get, this is the limit, h goes to zero, leaving that part alone, and the h alone, so 1 over h. Okay, and so now the j's are integrals. So this is the integral from a to c plus h of f of t dt. And then we're subtracting off the integral from a to c of f of t dt. Okay, so now I've plugged in all the definitions. So this is using definitions so far. Okay, and now I just have to compute, and let's see, so this, well, so first of all, if I have an integral from a to h, and I subtract off the integral from a to c, so let's see, so here's a over here, and I have an integral from a to h, from a to c plus h, and then I subtract off the integral from here to here, from a to c, then I'm just left with the integral from c to h. So writing that up, this is the limit h goes to zero, just leaving that part alone, 1 over h, leaving that alone. And I'm just going to replace my integral with the integral from c to c plus h. Okay, but that's the thing that I just computed a bound on right up here. All right, so so then we're almost done. Let's see, so this has an h in it, And I'm dividing by h, so these h's will cancel. And I'm left with that this is somewhere between f of c minus epsilon and f of c plus epsilon. Okay, but now I reminded you right at the beginning, this is done for every epsilon, right? So for every epsilon, I get that this derivative is between f of c plus epsilon and f of c minus epsilon, so it's actually equal to f of c. Djf at c is equal to f of c cubed. Okay, any questions about that proof? Okay, then I would like to take some corollaries that follow from it. Okay, so right, so first, as advertised here, I'm going to get that every continuous function is actually a derivative, okay? And that's going to be quite helpful. So this is a corollary to 12.4 that tells me that, okay? And so let me just write that out. If we have a continuous function, on AB, but then it's actually a derivative. And actually it's fairly immediate from the 12.4 because we actually wrote down what it's a derivative of. Okay, so proof F is a derivative. Of J f of x, which is the integral from a to x f of t dt, by what we just finished doing, by 12.4. Okay, so we're done, right? It is a derivative. Okay, so that's something we'd tried to prove, we'd claimed was true quite a long time ago, but now we finally have a way to get to prove it. Okay, let me add one more corollary, but then I'm going to come back and use this one here to play around a little bit with functions that we can get now.
Professor?
Yes?
Could I ask a question, actually?
Yes.
So in the theorem, how did we know that JFC is, J of F of C is differentiable at that point?
All right, okay. Yeah, that's a good point. Right, so yeah, so as you mentioned over here, to see that our to see that we're in our theorem here, we need that J is differentiable at this point. And what this theorem tells us is that as long as F is continuous at that point, then JF will be differentiable at that point. And that follows because we proved it because we wrote down the actual derivative. We computed the derivative and found that that limit exists.
Okay. So, okay. Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. So that. Yeah. Right. So all we needed to get the result was this initial input data that the function f was continuous at that point. Okay. And so as long as we start with an f that's continuous at every point, then we're within, then we fall within the preview of that theorem.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other questions about this one? Okay, so one other thing that follows from this is that if I look at this map here, now we have the integral goes back the other way. And it's an inverse to D, so that means that D is actually a bijection, all right? So let me just write that down. Second corollary to 12.4 and 8.35. Says that we get a bijection. So D, mapping the continuously differentiable functions that happen to be zero at A to the continuous functions on AB is a bijection. Okay, so proof from but 12.4 shows us that it's onto because we just found something. So by 12.4, D is onto. Okay, because we just wrote something as a, it's a derivative of something in particular, since D applied to JF is equal to f, okay? So we found a specific function. And 8.35 tells us that it's injective. So by 8.35, D is injective since, well, if we had D of f equal to D of G, or in other words, F prime is equal to G prime, then they differ by a constant. But we have this extra hypothesis to fix that, that they're both zero at A, okay? And there's a, and therefore the constant is zero. People creeping around behind me. Anyway, so that tells us that constant is zero. But since f of a equals g of a equals zero, and this is also equal to g of a plus c, we have c equals zero. So in other words, f is equal to g, and we have that it's injective. Okay, so any questions about that? So that tells us a little bit more, and maybe I'll add that to my diagram, because I like to play with my diagram. So this is a bijective. Okay. All right, so one thing that people like to do with this is now that we see that whenever we have a continuous function, we can get new functions by integrating it, okay? And in fact, that'll give us all the one-time differentiable functions. That's a handy way to build new functions, okay? And maybe three examples of that just to give a little bit of a feel. So new functions via integration. So it sort of fits with our theme. We found new functions by limits, and here we get new functions by integration. Okay, and so let me just start with one that, in fact, you might have even seen in Math 21. Of course, you use this function, but you might have seen this way of defining it, and that's the log. So, example, and this is 12.14 in the text. You can define the natural log by using the integral. So, natural log of x is just the integral of 1 to x of dt over t. And so that's the natural log is the area under that curve, and it can be handy, and you can prove things about it just using the fact that it comes from that integral. So one of the most useful properties, of course, of the natural log is that the natural log of a product is the sum of the natural logs. And you can prove that using the fact that it's an integral. So let me just do that. So let me do the right-hand side. So the natural log of x plus the natural log of y. If I use this definition, that's the integral from 1 to x of dt of t, plus the integral from 1 to y of dt of t. Okay, and so that means that I'm integrating from 1 to x here, and then I'm integrating from 1 to y, and I want to add those, and they don't add very well because they overlap. But what I'd like is to integrate from 1 to x and then from x to something, and then they will overlap. Then they will not overlap, and I can just add them together. And so the trick for that is to use a substitution. So I'll make a substitution in the second one. Okay, and I want it to start at x, so I'm going to take when t is equal to 1, I want s to be equal to x, so s will be x times t, so if t equals 1, then I have s is equal to x, okay, so this will be the integral from x, and when t is equal to y, s is equal to xy, so it'll be to xy, okay, and let's see, so then t is equal to 1 over s over x. Okay, so this will be over, when I take 1 over t, that'll be x over s. And dt is going to be, and this is the only tricky bit here, x is a constant, s is a variable, right? So it's ds over x. So then they cancel and I get x ds. Okay, and so then the x's cancel and I'm left with the same integral. So this is then the integral from 1 to xy of dt over t. That's the trick, which is of course the definition of the natural log of the product xy. All right, so in any case, the point is that you can use the fact that you gave it this definition to get properties of your functions. And there are other examples that people use. Okay, maybe I'll do one more just to get a little more of practice. Example. All right, so I claim that there's exactly one function. With a third derivative function capital F, with the third derivative equal to something e to the minus x squared. Now, finding functions, finding a formula for a function whose derivative is e to the minus x squared is hard. You can do it with series, and we'll come back and play with series. But in any case, we have this property, and I need some extra conditions. And now, of course, we know that there are several functions with the same derivative. They differ by a constant. So I need to give some initial conditions. So f of 0 equals f prime of 0 equals f of 1 equals 0. So that's enough conditions. Okay. So I have three derivatives, and so I have three conditions. All right, and so... proof. Okay, so we can just start doing it one step at a time using 8.35, this factor over here that tells us that if I have two things with the same derivative, then they differ by a constant. Okay, so also, and I'm going to use the fact that since this function is continuous, I know that it is a derivative of something. Okay, so there's something over here that has it as its derivative. Okay, since e to the minus x squared is continuous, there is g prime of x equals e to the minus x squared by the corollary above. Right, that tells us that every continuous function is a derivative, and that's what we're making use of here. All right, and so and then we can just keep going. So let me see, h double prime minus x squared, and then we'll have this k triple prime. All right, and but now by 8:35, there's only one constant that we can get at each time, and every function with derivative e to the minus x squared is a g of x plus some constant c. And then we can just keep going. So every function with a second derivative e to the minus x squared is going to be this h of x plus cx plus d. We get this one more. And our f has to be k of x plus, and we integrate one more time. So 1/2 cx squared plus x d plus some new constant, let me call it b. Okay, but now we can use our initial conditions. Right, and so we have that capital F of 0 is supposed to be 0, so that's going to be k of 0 plus 0 plus 0 plus b, so that tells us that what b is, minus k of 0, and 0 is equal to f prime of 0, equals k prime of 0 plus 0 plus d. So d is equal to minus k prime of 0. And then finally, 0 is equal to f of 1, which is equal to k of 1 plus 1/2 c plus d plus b. So we get that 1/2 c is equal to minus k of 1 minus d, so that makes it a plus k prime of 0 minus b, so that makes it a plus k of 0. And so we've solved for b, c, and d. And so we've decided what that is. And there's a unique set F. Okay, so notice that we managed to do this without ever writing a formula for what that capital F is. We just showed that it exists. Okay, so any questions about that? Okay, so then the next thing I wanted to do was try to see just how general this fact that D and J are inverses to each other is. And it would be nice if we could take everything that was a derivative and go back. We can't quite do that, okay? And the problem is that some of these derivatives might not be Riemann integrable. So, but if we make the extra restriction that our a derivative, that we have a differentiable function whose derivative is Riemann integrable, then we can go back. And so let me write out an example of that, and then the proof of the theorem. Okay, so question. So if I look at this function here, this is a function which is differentiable, but its derivative is not continuous. Okay, so let me call it the g of x equal to x squared sine 1 over x for 0. So the first if x is non-zero and 0 if x is equal to 0. So our usual function has the derivative g prime of x, which we computed early on in the course. And you can just use the rules for the first part of it. So that's going to be 2x sine of 1 over x minus cosine of 1 over x for x not equal to 0. And then the hard work was figuring out what it was at 0, and we worked out that it was 0, okay? It has, which is not continuous. At 0. Okay, so we want to know, is it so true that if I integrate from 0 to x, this g prime of x dx, this is still equal to g of x minus g of 0, which I guess is just g of x. Right, so that's the type of question that that we'd like to answer. And let me write down the theorem that says that it is. So the answer is yes. And the theorem is as follows. This is 12.1. And it says that if we start with a function which is differentiable, let me write it the way we usually do it. So normally I just write it differentiable on the open interval. And then I add one more little condition. It's a very minor, that it's also continuous at the end. We know that if it's differentiable, it's continuous everywhere inside, but I also want it to be continuous at the end. And we've seen this condition before. But now the new condition that's important, although it's tricky to find counterexamples, but we can't even really talk about the interval if it's not true, is that the derivative is Riemann integrable. Okay, so that's the one extra condition that we need. Then we're going to get the result that if I do what we did up here, first take the derivative, and then take the integral. So let me write that with my j's and d's. So I'm going to take the integral of the derivative of my function f, evaluated at x, and that's going to be f of x minus f of a. And just to remind you what this means, this is equal to, by definition, the integral from a to x of f prime of t dt. Okay, so that's what you would expect to be that right hand side. Okay, so I wanted two things. First, I want to motivate why this is yes. So if I just go through why this one fits. So this says that my function has to be differentiable. Okay, here's its derivative. So it's differentiable. Good. It has to be continuous. Okay, so this function is continuous. Actually, I guess I didn't even say what the interval was, but it's actually continuous on all of R, so it's a continuous in every interval. Okay, so that's easy. How do I know that this derivative is Riemann integrable? So does anyone remember? We had some criteria for when a function is Riemann integrable. Here's the derivative. We computed that. How do I know that that function is Riemann integrable? No, let me use it. I'll just give an interval. It doesn't matter. It's true for every interval. Since, does anyone remember? We had a criterion for when functions were Riemann integrable.
Is it that it's continuous? Because
it's almost continuous. It's discontinuous at one point.
Right. Okay. So that's not it. Yeah.
But it's close. It's close, right? Because what we said was that you have to look at the set of discontinuities. If it has none, then it is. But as long as that set of discontinuities is in this set Z, so for example, if it were finite, that would be enough. And this one is discontinuous only at zero. So it's because it's almost continuous. It's because it's continuous except at one at a finite number of points. So one, just one point. So that's where that. Since the discontinuities of G prime are just the single point zero, which is finite, okay, and that's proved last time here. I think I wrote it on the other side, but we have here that that there's this collection Z, and the finite sets are all inside of this Z. Okay, so it meets the hypotheses of my theorem. The derivative is Riemann integrable, and it is itself differentiable and continuous. Okay, and so then I just want to prove the theorem. So proof of 12.1. Okay. Well, so I want to make use of the fact that this derivative is an integrable, because that was the tricky extra hypothesis. And so since that's integrable, that tells me that I can find a partition that approximates it well. So let me do that. Okay, so for all epsilon greater than zero, I can choose a partition so that the upper and lower estimates by that partition are close, okay, with integral from a to x of f prime of t dt is equal to, of course, the upper and lower, because it's integrable. Okay, but I can bound these. So the lower one is less than or equal to, I can take the lower one associated to this partition. Oops. This wrote that a partition, it's supposed to be an element of the partition. Sorry, okay, so it's just a partition of AB, all right, some partition of AB. Okay, so if I use that partition, it's a good estimate. So that means that I'm off by at most epsilon. So if I add epsilon, then I've got enough, okay? And similarly, it's a good estimate for the upper bound, so I can take the upper bound using the partition P, and that's too big by at most epsilon. Okay, so the upper one's a little bit too big, but no more than epsilon. The lower one's a little bit too small, but no more than epsilon. Okay, and then we finally are going to do this last computation. So let me take what I have up there. So L prime, L of F prime with the partition P. All right, so what is that? So just by definition, that's going to be the sum I equals 1 to N of these Li's, the lengths of each partition, and then the sup or the inf. And sorry, this is L, so it's inf over the t inside of the interval I sub I of my value f prime of t. Okay, and then the final thing is I want to make use of the mean value theorem, right? So I have these two values x I minus 1, xi, and I have a slope in here somewhere, and that minimum slope is less than or equal to the slope that I have at the end, because there's somewhere where I have that slope. Okay, so this is less than or equal to, and this is by the mean value theorem. So I'm going to leave the sum alone, I equals 1 to n. I'm going to leave the lengths alone. Okay, but now I'm going to use the mean value theorem to replace that infimum with the value f at the far right endpoint, so f of xi, minus f at the far left endpoint, f of xi minus 1, divided by the length xi minus xi minus 1. Okay, so this is by the mean value theorem. I know I have at least one point inside of there with that slope, and so the smallest slope, this infimum, is less than or equal to this slope. Okay, that's equal to the slope at some point. Maybe I'll add that in. Right, so mean value theorem tells me that's actually f prime at some point c, so the infimum is less than that, less than equal to that. Okay, but now everything telescopes. So then this is equal to the sum I equals 1 to n. The xi minus xi minus 1 is just l, so those cancel, and I'm left with f of xi minus f of xi minus 1. But now I'm going to add and subtract the xi's and the xi's minus 1's until I get to the endpoints. So this will just be f at the far right endpoint, which is f at x, minus f at the far left endpoint, which is f at a. Okay. Which is what we were trying to prove. Okay. Maybe I should just say, okay, I guess I should say one more thing. Similarly for the u, so u of f prime of p will be bigger than or equal to f of x minus f of a. Okay. So then maybe I'll add in. So then up here, then this is less than or equal to f of x minus f of a plus epsilon, and this is bigger than or equal to f of x minus f of a minus epsilon. Okay, any questions about that one? All right, so what we get is we get this space of functions that are sort of live in between here, whose derivatives are Riemann integrable. And for those, we get things going back and forth. It's a kind of complicated set of functions, but for specific functions, it's not so hard usually to detect whether they fit the criterion, like my example here. Okay, I will stop here and stick around in case there are questions.